You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Come on, say it out loud with me. And darkness and decay and the Red Death held illimitable dominion over all. Look at that sentence. Who says Edgar Allan Poe was a lousy stylist? 13 words, a good number for a horror story, right? Although, it's not so much a story as a mask. Yes, it's about a mask, but it is a mask, too. Of course you all know what a mask is. If you didn't, you looked it up in your dictionaries, because that's what you do in a senior seminar. Anyone? No, not a play, not exactly. Yes? Good, okay, masquerade is one sense of the word, a ball whose guests attend in costume. Anyone else? Yes, very nice, nicely put. The mask does begin in the 16th century. It's the entertainment of the elite, and originally it's a combination of pantomime and dance. Pantomime. Right, think mime. The idea is to perform without words, gesturally, to let the movements of your body tell the story. You do that, and you dance, and there's your show. Later on, there's dialogue and other additions, but I think it's this older sense of the word the story intends. Remember that tall, silent figure at the end? I'm sorry? Oh, yes, good point. The two kinds of masks converge. Back to that sentence, though. 22 syllables that break almost perfectly in half, 10 and 12. And darkness and decay and the Red Death, and held illimitable dominion over all. A group of short words, one and two syllables each, takes you through the first part of the sentence, then they give way to these long, almost luxurious words, illimitable dominion. The rhythm, you see how complex it is. You ride along on these short words, bouncing up and down, alliterating from one D to the next, and suddenly you're mired in those Latinate polysyllables. All the momentum goes out of your reading. There's just enough time for the final pair of words, which are short, which is good, and you're done.
John Langan is the author of Mr. Gaunt and Other Uneasy Encounters. His novel is House of Windows. His new collection of short stories is The Wide Carnivorous Sky and Other Monstrous Geographies. Thank you for joining me, John.
Thank you very much for having me, Rick.
John, as much as you are a writer of horror fiction, it seems to me that you are a man who's haunted by literature itself.
Yes. for a good part of my life, I knew I wanted to be a writer. And when I was still in high school and I had aspirations of being a writer, I went around and asked my teachers, what book should I read? If I want to be a great writer, what are the books that I should read? And they would give me these lists of, you know, five books. And I did the same thing when I got to college, when I was an undergraduate. I went around to the professors I particularly esteemed and said, okay, what's my reading list if I want to be a great writer? And I was also an English literature major. So part of it was, what are the things I need to have read to be a well-rounded English major? And that has never halted. It's never stopped. It's remained, for me, a passion, an obsession, I suppose. And I suppose in part that's because the more you read, I think anyway, the more you read, the more you see the work of literature that you're looking at the current moment contains traces, echoes, even anticipations of other literary works, and so you start to see the whole thing as tied together in this great web, I suppose, or I'll steal a term from Deleuze and Guattari and call it a rhizome. I think that for me as a writer, that I can imagine how a writer could feel really put off by that. But for me, that became a source of fascination and a source of stories, really, a source of narrative. I can go back to the writers, the stories that came before me, and engage them and draw new stories, draw my own stories out of them. And often that's, you know, as in the case of the excerpt that I read from Technicolor, that was facilitated by Ellen Datlow putting together an anthology of stories that were supposed to be inspired by Edgar Allan Poe stories. And so that gave me a chance to do that in a very direct kind of way. But in my other fiction, quite often when I'm casting around for how I'm going to do it, there's a sense in which it's at least the early part of it starts as me thinking to myself, oh, what would happen if Thornton Wilder wrote Night of the Living Dead? And, you know, things that sound almost like proposals for a Saturday Night Live skit or something like that, but which I hope lead in interesting directions.
Speaking of Thornton Wilder, your story in which opens the book, How the Day Runs Down, this is an absolutely amazing story because it captures what I think are the most powerful aspects of both of those works. The small town insights and that kind of everyday feel of Thornton Wilder and that deep penetrating look at an American landscape, and also the emotions and the terror of Night of the Living Dead, and not in a really powerful manner. I'd like you to talk about that's a deep challenge to take on to put upon yourself, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about finding that story within those two stories, because you have a really wonderful narrative there.
Well, it was it's quite fascinating. I mean, I fascinate myself. It's quite fascinating in retrospect to me, because what came first was the voice of the stage manager. When I was in high school and when I was an undergraduate, I had read and seen productions of Our Town, it felt like 100 times. In retrospect, it was probably 3 or 4. But I felt that I, for some reason, knew the stage manager's voice. And when I was in my early 20s, maybe mid-20s, and this was before the whole zombie craze of the last decade plus, but I just thought to myself that it would be sort of funny. I could hear the stage manager talking about zombies, the monologue with which he opens the story is pretty much almost exactly what I wrote about 20 years ago now. It just came to me in a bolt, and then it stopped for a while, because I had this sort of opening monologue in which the stage manager is just taking this sort of folksy approach to explaining the zombie epidemic to you, and then that was sort of morbidly amusing. But from there, I couldn't quite figure out where it was going to go. And then many years later, almost like 15 years later, John Joseph Adams, the editor and anthologist, told me, I'm putting together an anthology of zombie stories. And I said to him, that's funny, I have this zombie story. I had this idea for a zombie story. And he said to me, oh, you have to write it. And I thought, okay, I'll give it a try. And so I went back to Wilder. And one of the things I was thinking about in Wilder, obviously, the overview of the town, but then also the focus that he brings in the narrative to the young woman who realizes how precious our lives are and how fleeting they are, how ephemeral they are. And so I thought that was something that I could riff on. And I liked the idea very much that the stage manager himself would be affected by the events that were going on in the narrative. It would not be Wilder stage manager who stands back, you know, as a stage manager would. This is somebody who becomes embroiled in what's going on and who, in a sense, is as doomed, I guess, in some sense, as the rest of the characters are. So it just bubbled up originally out of my out of my subconscious, and then I suppose I often think that, you know, I teach creative writing, and I'll often tell my creative writing students, throw nothing away, because even if you reach a point where you feel you're really blocked and you need to move on to something else, I really believe that your brain on some level, it's like a great apartment building or something, and on the middle levels, or maybe even way deep down in the sub basement, your creative faculties are working on that idea, are trying to figure out that idea, are testing things and saying, no, this works, but that doesn't, or vice versa. So, yeah, I think there was probably some way in which I had never stopped working on that story. And then when the opportunity arose to do something with it, I was able to.
You know, one of the things I really like about all the the stories in your book. And in this story, too, it's a story where the narrative changes the narrator, and where the narrative, the fact that it's addressed to the audience, to the reader, brings us in closer. You do this a lot, and you do it very well. It's a dicey thing to do. So I'd like you to talk about your sense of using the story to change the narrator and to change the audience and involve the audience really directly in the action.
Sure. I think, you know, on the one hand, I think that this is the great promise of a horror narrative, is that it can affect the audience. And obviously we think about this in a very visceral kind of way, that it can, and I suppose the mental image that we all have is one that's derived from the film audience, you know, watching something that just makes us scream, jump in our seats, or what have you. And there are books, I suppose, and stories that can produce a similar effect on us. We read them and we're terrified. We don't want to. We're reading them late at night. We're the only ones who are awake in the house, and we put the book down, and suddenly we think, "Oh, I've got to get up and go brush my teeth, and I really don't want to do that. Maybe I can just stay in my bed for the rest of the night." And so that's an immediate kind of promise, I think, of the horror narrative, that visceral affect. And I think that it's an entirely valid effect, I suppose, for want of a better word. I think it's a valid purpose to the horror story. But I also think that, as with any work of literature, there are more things that it can do. And the best stories of all are those which linger. I suppose the very best stories of all are the ones that, when you look up from them for a minute, it feels as if the story is more real than what's going on around you.
The memory of what you read sometimes can be the equivalent of your memory of something you've really experienced.
I think so. I think you can feel as if you're still walking around inside the story. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's an absolutely, I think it's an absolutely wonderful feeling. And I think, to be honest, I think that, to make just a vast generalization, I think all literature wants that. All literature wants to so wrap you in itself that afterwards you'll be changed. Afterwards you will take the book or the story, and you will give it to a friend, and you will say, "You have to read this, because this has changed me. This has made a difference to me." Even if you don't say that explicitly, the fact that you're passing it on is testament to that. And so I think, for me, the desire I have is to write things that will engage the reader in these on a multiplicity of levels. It may be shameful to admit, but whenever someone comes up to me and says, "Oh, I couldn't get out of bed and brush my teeth because your story scared me so badly," it warms the cockles of my heart. I'm quite pleased. At the same time, when somebody says to me, "Wow, that was really, I really thought about that story for days. That really spoke to me in various ways, shapes, and forms," that's as satisfying, maybe even more satisfying in some ways, because that immediate visceral effect can often, I mean, it has a limited shelf life, I think, whereas the story that really causes, that really grips you and insinuates itself into your dreams, into your subconscious, ultimately your conscious, I think that has a much longer shelf life. So I think this is a sort of, I don't know, sort of roundabout way of thinking through this. I think that if you want that to happen, it comes back probably to almost entirely to character, that you have to be willing to change your characters and change them in profound ways. I can remember, I want to say when I was a kid, Clive Barker had a statement about writing horror stories, and he said that, in his horror stories, his characters always lost something, whether it was something, a literal part of themselves or a sort of figurative part of themselves, but they were changed by that experience. I can remember as a kid thinking, "Oh, that's terrible, those poor characters." But as I've gotten older, I think, well, but we identify with those characters, and if the characters, if we have a strong enough connection to them and they're changed, then I think we're changed too by extension. Well, any effective or most effective writing, I suppose, when it comes to fiction, really has to do with character. And so I try to create compelling characters and then do terrible things to them.
One of the things I think you do that's really interesting is you write a number of your stories in the second person. That's a challenge because you're turning the reader into a character. I'm thinking of The Revel, which I think is a brilliant, brilliant story. I mean, it's just knocked my socks off to become that character. So I'd like you to talk about making the choice to write in the second person.
Well, thank you. It just seemed an extension of trying to involve the reader in what I was doing. You know, there's a quote from Peter Straub. He said something to the effect of, I value virtuosity, the ability to do undoable things. It's one of those quotes that I look to, and I think to myself, okay, if you're going to keep moving forward as a writer, if you're going to keep things fresh, keep things dynamic, you need to keep challenging yourself. And certainly you can challenge yourself, and sometimes I have done, by trying to write a story that is absolutely traditional, that is that M.R. James himself would be proud of, although James himself is a more dynamic writer than he often gets credit for. But nonetheless, something that's in the right in the middle of literary tradition, of a ghost story tradition or what have you. And then I suppose there's the flip side of that, which is you can just really jazz around, as I think John Gardner called it. It was his word for sort of postmodern experimentation, jazzing around. So sometimes I think to myself, okay, it's time to jazz around. It's time of, what are you going to try now? What are you going to, what kinds of things are you going to do? And second person, it seems so natural in a way for a horror story because of what I was talking about before, that intense identification with the characters in the story. If you don't have that intense identification with the characters in a horror narrative, whether film or book, it fails. It just becomes spectacle, and it becomes almost a sort of sadistic kind of spectacle. And it was one of the challenges when I started writing horror, and I would talk to friends about it. I had a number of friends say to me, yeah, you know, when I watch a horror movie, or if I read a horror story or whatever, I don't get attached to the characters because I know they're all just going to die. So why should I invest the emotional? You know, why should I set myself up for that? And so I thought to myself, ah, well, that's going to be a challenge for me as a writer, is how am I going to hook the audience in? How am I going to catch those people, as it were? And so the you seemed a shortcut to doing that. It seemed a way to, from a kind of rhetorical standpoint, I suppose, to disorient the reader a little bit so that they couldn't distance themselves from the character because they were the character. And obviously, if they were prepared, if they're the kind of reader who's prepared to identify with the character, then this would really amp that up for them. And if they're not, if there's somebody who's, oh, I'm going to keep a distance from this character, it would maybe help to get past their defenses. And then I just tried to run with it and just see where it took me.
It's such a beautifully written story. You, within this kind of experimental inception, you play with all the classic aspects of the horror story itself. You give us a cabin in the woods. You give us, you know, all the parts of the story and say, okay, here's this part, here's that part. And when you were writing this story, did this just flow from one end to the other? Or it seems like a story that you could have maybe put together almost modularly.
Well, it was part of or most of a novel that had kind of gone off the rails. It was when I came back to writing horror fiction. There was in my 20s, I sort of moved away from writing horror fiction because I got really anxious about whether it was literary enough to be working. You know, the anxiety of respectability, I suppose you would call it. And then when I met my wife, she was like, why worry about that? Just if you like it, do it. And so I this werewolf thing was the first thing that I really went, started writing at length. And originally, I had a much more intrusive narrator who was framing a lot of this stuff. And the story kind of collapsed, it stalled under the burden of its own pretensions, I suppose. And then I'm trying to think. I actually had an invitation to contribute a story to a volume of werewolf stories, and I thought about this, and I thought, wow, I wonder if I could go back to that and kind of cut out, excise the good parts. And I thought to myself, rather than having an obtrusive narrator who's going on and on and on, and there is still some of that in the story, but I thought by breaking the story up and by using titles, really, I thought that I could get away with or accomplish, I suppose, a lot of the same thing that I'd been trying to do with this original style of narration.
You know, one thing that strikes me about all the stories in this book and, you know, all of your work in general is you bring to each story a unique and distinctive prose style that is perfectly suited for that story, whether it's, you know, the voice of the stage manager and how the day runs down, the voice of the lecturer in Technicolor, or the, I guess I would call it, cinematic voice of the title story, or, you know, the very intense and inwound and inbred Dickensian tone of House of Windows. But they're very, very different. And I really like the attention, your ability to craft great prose that's in a variety of styles that targets, that slots in with the nature and the subject of the story you're telling.
Well, thank you. I do look at the prose style as very important, as an integral component of the story that I'm telling. I suppose I think of myself in a lot of ways as a kind of formalist, in that I see the horror story in general as having a certain kind of shape, in the same way that the sonnet has a shape. And then within that overarching form, there are subgenres, subforms, variations. And so a lot of times when I sit down to write a story, one of the things I'm thinking to myself is what kind of story is this and what are its requirements? In writing the title story, The Wide Carnivorous Sky, that was a story about a bunch of Iraqi war veterans dealing with this monstrous entity. And so I thought to myself, you know, the kind of layered, mannered style, the sort of Henry Jamesian style that I really like in a lot of my fiction, I don't think that's going to be as appropriate here. And I need something that tends more in the direction of, you know, see what James Dickey was up to in Deliverance or something like that. A style that can still be lyric and still be dense even, but which is more attuned to the physical world and the physical world of action and of violence. Part of it, I suppose, is also almost for my own entertainment. There are times when I'll be laboring in a story and I'll be getting close to the end of a story, and I'll think to myself, man, I can't wait to get done with this style so I can move on to another style. There's an element, I guess, of almost something like ventriloquism or something like that, that what is the voice that tells this story? You know, when I was a kid, I read a ton of Faulkner and just sort of soaked myself in Faulkner in my late teens and early 20s. And I suspect it's in part a residue of that, of just this sense that every time you read a Faulkner story, you never know what the voice is going to be, but you know the voice is going to fit that story, at least for the span of great novels. And I suppose it's you know, to some degree, feeling that the voice, if the voice can fit the story, or the closer the fit between voice and story, then the greater the impact, the impact the story is going to have.
I really like the way that you use the aura of fear and terror, but not just to gross us out or not just to terrorize us, but to take us through a variety of textures of the experience of life and our lives and the way we live now. And I think that you do a great job of using the genre as a means to explore something much more wider than just the genre, or even than literary fiction or any other kind of non-genre fiction would be able to accomplish.
Well, thank you. Thank you. That's absolutely my intent. I mean, when I came to reading horror fiction, it was Stephen King was really, and Peter Straub and Charles Grant were on the upswing. And Clive Barker would break within a year or two of me starting to read this stuff. And one of the things that I remember vividly was, you know, King in interviews, in reviews, brief articles, and in his book Danse Macabre, which was hugely important to me when I was a kid and still really is. King would not confine his discussion of horror novels or to the traditional Dracula, Frankenstein, Dr. Jekyll, and Mr. Hyde. He would certainly mention those, but he would branch out and talk about something like Thomas Pynchon's V as a horror novel. And people have talked about that, have sort of dismissed that, and said, well, that's such a reductive way to think of V. But to my mind, it was such an expansive way to think about horror, that horror was, yes, you could have vampires and the beast without a name and the werewolf, absolutely, but you could also have this crazy narrative of historical conspiracy and this mysterious V that runs through it all. That would also that was also answering what horror could do and could be. And so I still tend to think of horror in a more expansive kind of way. I realize that the criticism of that can be, well, if horror can be anything, then it isn't anything. You know, that we need to have something more readily identifiable genre markers or something like that. And I'm sensitive to that. But having said that, I still think that there are a great many more things that would fall under the eaves of the horror tent, I suppose, than just those things that have the genre markers in them. A year or two ago, Donald Ray Pollock wrote a book called The Devil All the Time.
That was a fantastic book, and horror completely.
Yeah, it's that place where horror and crime and religious narrative or religious meaning all come together. And it's so dark. there's a writer, a friend of mine named Nathan Ballingrud, who has his first short story collection coming out, North American Lake Monsters. And Nathan uses a lot more of the horror, standard horror tropes, vampires, werewolves, what have you. But he's doing that same thing. I think he's pushing that same broad sense that this is a way in which you can talk not just about something that likes to suck your blood or what have you, but you can really talk about what's going on all over the place.
Well, that's one of the things I really like about, I think, about the horror genre in particular, is it's a fine way of externalizing things that are very difficult to talk about in a manner that's easy to read, easy to understand what's being externalized, entertaining, and if it's done well, it doesn't hit you over the head with it, but it levers open those points in your mind and in your perceptions that might not otherwise be amenable to being levered open.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think the other thing that probably shaped me was coming out of reading, growing up reading King and reading Straub especially. These were two guys who were taking importing, I suppose you would say, especially to the horror novel, stuff that came from the naturalist novel or the modernist novel, and then sort of blending that with the stuff of horror fiction. I want to say it was Dale Bailey who said that they were writing social melodramas, I think was what he called them, you know, i.e. in the style of Dickens. And I often think that may be where King's, you know, a good part of his success lies is the monsters are great and the fantastic stuff is great, but that sense of that he gives of showing you this is the way we live now, to steal from Anthony Trollope, he does that as powerfully and as well as does Straub, as any other writer who's writing as you know, as you're saying, as sort of a mainstream venue or what have you.
Well, I would, for my money, I would say King and you as well are showing the middle class in a way that nobody else does, and showing it better and more clearly, monster, supernatural, and werewolves aside. I mean, this stuff, as you said at the beginning, what matters is character. And I think your characters seem very clear and very real to us. I'm thinking, too, in The City of the Dog, which is a wonderful, wonderful story. So I'd like you to talk about creating the characters for that story and the the milieu for that kind of that vision of a city?
Well, I think you know, I had lived in Albany for a couple of years when I was younger, and hadn't had the greatest experience of it. And I had had a running joke with Ellen Datlow for a long time because she'd gone to SUNY Albany as for undergraduate, and she told me, "Yeah, I didn't have such a great." I don't know how we came to be talking about this, but at some convention or another, she said, "Yeah, I didn't have a great time in Albany either." And I said, "Someday, Ellen, I'll write you a horror story about Albany, the horrors of Albany." And then I had the opportunity to write this story about ghouls under the streets of Albany. You know, it's interesting because that story, when I was writing that, I was under a lot of pressure. I was trying to get it done very quickly, and so I imported a lot of autobiography into that story. A lot of my own unhappiness when I was in my early 20s. You know, this would have been what I suppose the early 90s when. The economy had still really stalled, and when the world itself just seemed to not only be stalling but just heading in really a really bad direction. The Yugoslavia was breaking up, and people were just slaughtering each other. Rwanda was happening. It was a time when the sort of euphoria of the late 80s. It was as if this was the hangover or something like that from the sort of euphoria of the late 80s. Fall of the Berlin Wall and all the end of communism, all this kind of stuff. All of a sudden, we'd woken up to this world that was, you know, just sort of horrifying. And so, I took a lot of that stuff and I took a lot of those sentiments and included them in the story. As much, I mean, to be honest, by sort of gut feeling, by instinct, that just and I think it's part of. For me, what sort of methodology, I guess, or aesthetic, I guess, that I've sort of evolved loosely, which is that a lot of times I'll include stuff in a story to try to round out the details of a character, and that is something I think you could trace directly back from me reading someone like King when I was a kid, because of course King loves to do that. But I'll bring details into the story. I'll tell you about the character. Almost into with a sort of intuitive sense that, okay, just let's find out stuff about this character. And what winds up happening is it sets up the possibility then that when the supernatural menace intrudes or the supernatural element intrudes, whatever it is, what you've told the reader about the character, this sketch almost that you've done, or profile, I guess, that you've done of the character, that's going to interact with the supernatural element in ways that you as the writer are not going to be able to anticipate and that are going to bring to the story more than you could have consciously planned. That it's going to give allow the reader into the story and allow the reader to make connections between the realistic elements and the non-realistic elements that are going to, I think, feel very personal to the reader in an odd kind of way, and so it's going to give the story, I think, a feeling of more resonance.
One of the things I think that makes your stories powerful is in general in this book the length to which you write. Jeffrey Ford mentions this in the introduction, and I would say this is true, that. To be honest, most of the stories in this book, with two exceptions, read to me almost like short novels, and have. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, they have, when I'm done reading that story, they have the feel of a novel, and you know, you give us a full world, you give us full characters, we have a complete arc. It's really a very satisfying read, irregardless of any of the subject matter or anything. I think that. You've managed to find a way to write at a length that is economical for readers to actually read in the real world, but has that real full feeling. I'd like you to talk about finding that, you know, balance of density, length, and depth that gives us such nice, full, great, it's a hearty meal stories, as it were.
Sure, thanks. You know, I Don't get me wrong. I would love to be able to write 5-page stories. if I could write 5-page stories, I feel like I could just be so much more productive. But for me, the problem, to be somewhat more serious, for myself writing short stories, was that so many short stories, short horror stories, wind up as what I think of as trap stories. There's a character, and the character stumbles into some trap and is horribly killed. There's a place for those, certainly, but after one or two or ten of them, you want to talk about a form, and you want to talk about, you know, sort of formal restrictions or formal challenges. That strikes me as an astoundingly challenging one. So I think, and I also think that it's like a potato chip or something. It's not, I mean, it might taste good at the moment, but it's not really filling. And if my ambition is to get, you know, to give you the good meal, to give you something that that you will digest and that then will become part of you, I need more. And part of it, I guess, has to do pretty much from the get-go. When I came back to writing horror, I thought, you know, that it needs to be about the characters. It needs to be character development. And character development almost needs to trump everything else, and or at least be co-equal with everything else. And I thought to myself, if you're going to do that, you need time. You can't rush it. And so that meant working at this length. I mean, a lot of the stories when I sit down to write, yeah, wind up at about 10,000 words, between 10 and 12,000 words. So you know, like a 50-page or thereabouts sort of mark. And it seems to be that at this point, that's about the length my sort of subconscious has determined. Okay, you know, that's you've done it. You've developed. You've put all your dominoes up. Now you can knock them over and watch them fall down. But the stories, honestly, the stories I enjoy reading tend to be longer stories. I have some friends. There's a contemporary writer named Paul Tremblay who writes brilliant short horror stories. A collection called In the Meantime that's full of all these, you know, just little ice picks. But a lot of the stuff that I lean towards, that I look forward to, is stuff in the novelette or the novella, you know, the sort of short novel kind of thing. When I again, if I look back to my childhood, you know, a lot of King and Straub's best shorter work was not really that short. It was at this novella length. And I suppose too, like a lot of writers these days, if I look at what I've read the most of in my life, it's novels. So the novel, even though I've tried to read a lot of short stories, I'm sure that on some level the novel, probably deep down in my subconscious, the novel still exists as a kind of template for what I'm doing, more than the short story and its kind of epiphanic qualities. The novel and its narrative qualities, I think, the traditional narrative qualities, conflict, all this sort of stuff. I think that that's probably a model that just has ingrained itself in me, so that even if I'm writing for what's supposed to be an anthology or a magazine of stories, nonetheless, I'm reaching towards that, the feel of that, I guess.
And your novel, House of Windows, it's masterful and terrifying and also heartrending. And so I'd like you to talk about this. I think it's a really interesting line to cross between heartrending and heart-ripping, so to speak. But I think they lead well into one another.
They do. And you know, I the other, oh, in I guess about a year ago, I read an excerpt from the novel I'm trying to get done now at the school I teach at. And afterwards, one of my colleagues came up to me and said, rather befuddledly, "Well, that wasn't scary. That was just sad." I said, "Well, yeah. You know, it's. I mean, it sounds weird, but there was this, before Johnny Cash died, he had this quote about how country songs had used to, when he was a kid, sort of thing. When he was younger, country songs used to be able to have all kinds of things in them and still be country songs. And on some level, I think the same thing, yeah, that a horror novel can have whatever you want in it. It doesn't have to be just, if it's just about pure affect, just about the scare, then it's not really that interesting when all is said and done.
Nor is it that scary either, ultimately.
Yeah. Just, I mean, you can gross people out, you know, and so I actually, you know, with House of Windows, I really wanted, I really wanted two characters. I really wanted lead characters who would be complex and even unsympathetic at times, or maybe not unsympathetic, but unlikable. Sympathetic, but unlikable. And I worked really hard to make them these prickly, difficult characters that who would do terrible things in some cases, but motivated by sentiments that were ultimately maybe all too familiar, all too understandable. And I labored a long time on coming up with these characters who were walking this very fine line, I felt, between walking at the margins of the reader's sympathy, I guess, is how I might put it. Every now and again, you know, Peter Straub, I mean, one of the high points of my life was World Horror Convention a couple of years ago. Peter Straub accosted me to talk to me about the novel and asked me how I'd written it and this sort of stuff. And then it was one of those moments where I thought, okay, I can die now. This is about as good as it gets. But it was, you know, the other thing that just, I don't know, as a point of curiosity, I suppose, was that a year or two after I'd published it, I got an email, a nice email from a woman who said, yeah, I like that novel. Kind of reminds me of King Lear. And it was one of those knock me over with a feather moments, because I read and reread King Lear more times than I read Our Town when I was a kid. And it never once occurred to me consciously while I was writing the novel that, oh, here's a father who's a little bit iffy and he disowns a child and chaos and disaster descends on him and he's, you know, in love with his own language. And it never occurred to me that Lear might be, you know, standing in the background somewhere. And yet, in retrospect, it seems clear to me that it's there in some way, shape, or form in the background.
All of your work seems extremely well, intricately constructed. It's, you know, really, it seems like the kind of thing that you must have had to go through, like spreadsheet planning stage and an architectural map planning stage. I'm wondering how much of this stuff that you do in advance on paper and how much is just occurs in your ruminative mind and how much that just happens when you sit down at your computer keyboard?
I don't do a lot of planning beforehand. Usually what happens is, well, I often think about it as it's like that chemistry experiment you do in high school where they take the teacher takes a beaker full of water and like sugar, I think it is, and says, okay, this is a saturated solution, and then applies heat to it and says, now if we heat the water, we can add even more sugar because we're making the molecules farther apart and such. And they take the supersaturated solution, and I want to say they turn off the heat then, and then they stick a crystal rod into it, or a plastic rod or whatever into it, and all the sugar crystallizes around the rod. And I think to myself that I often feel is what my own creative process is like, that there are all these various ideas or what have you that might be swirling around, and then something drops in and bang, everything crystallizes around it, and it sort of locks into position. It's not to say that there's no, you know, it's not like the Platonic ideal or something like that, and then I just transcribe it. I keep notes, some notes as I go along, sometimes in the margins of what I write everything by hand on legal pads. It's just the way it works for me, and then I type it into the computer. So I'm revising as I go. You know, I would say that one of the lessons I learned, when I was in my early 20s, I wrote a novel that just will never see the light of day. But one of the things I learned writing that novel was write the novel you want to write. So I would have a vision for where I wanted things to go. I would have a sense of where things should go, and sometimes I would find myself going off track, and I said to myself, no, you can't do this. You have to go back, figure out where you took the wrong path, as it were, go back and get on the right path again, even if you have to discard 20 or 50 pages or something like that. And so that's a practice that I've tried to hold to with any kind of story that I'm writing. If it's a short story, not to be afraid to X out paragraphs or pages and say, nope, this isn't where I need to go. I need to do something else. I'm helped with longer stuff. My wife reads it. So she read my novel and made some comments on you know, the character motivation or actually, and the guy, I think it was Marty Greenberg, who was the, or Marty Halpern, it's terrible, I can't remember his name. Anyway, but the copy editor I had for House of Windows made some actually really good catches in terms of logical consistency.
I'm guessing that's Marty Halpern.
Marty Halpern, yeah, who is absolutely worth his weight in gold for having made those catches. It was really, I was very appreciative of that. Yeah, part of it is that I walk around feeling as if my head is about three sizes too big because I'm trying to hold all these different moving parts, I suppose, in place and try to understand how they relate to one another. And sometimes, too, in the process, once the novel is done or the story is done, if I have time, if I haven't run right up over a deadline, but if I have a little bit of time and I can look through it, then there's the chance to go back and say, oh, well, wait, if I add a little scene here, or I can maybe shift this paragraph there, and the thing will have a better formal shape.
I think the story that concludes your new collection, Mother of Stone, is really superb. It's very intense, and it has a really nice build to it. And I'd like you to talk about architecting that kind of build. And this is a very classic horror narrative in many ways, although you do give us another second-person narrator, which I think is really, it really works really, really well. And I'd like you to talk about taking these untraditional approaches to somewhat traditional narratives.
Well, it was, that story definitely felt like a bit of a gamble because it was so long, because it was second person. It had come out of an anecdote that a friend had told me. Actually, a friend's wife had told my wife and I while we were at dinner with them about, you know, she'd worked at a restaurant, a local restaurant, and they had unearthed this headless statue on the grounds of their while doing excavations for renovations or something like that, and they had. They'd unearthed this headless statue, and then there had been this horrific accident, and one of the people associated with this restaurant had been decapitated, and it was awful, and what have you. And I could not find any information on this. Of course, I searched online and what have you. But it just seemed like that, you know, sometimes you just feel the universe just hands you a story and just says, come on, don't blow this. And what two things happened, I suppose. One was that Ellen Datlow and Nick Mamatas were putting together an anthology called Haunted Legends, which was supposed to be about, you know, sort of revisionings of local horror stories, local ghost stories, you know, what have you. And I thought, well, this is perfect for that. The other detail, actually, that my friend's wife had told us was that an exorcism had been performed upon this statue. And in terms of thinking about kinds of horror narratives, well, the exorcism narrative is certainly one of them as well. But an exorcism on a statue is kind of unconventional. And so I thought to myself, wow, this, you know, everything comes together. There's the rod entering the superheated solution, supersaturated solution. There you go. But then the story just grew and grew and grew and grew. Some of what I wanted to do was tell the story in different voices, which to do within one story, one slightly longer story, I guess, things that I'd done in other individual stories. And then I also wanted, I really wanted to try to scare people with this story. I wanted this story to just be full of really sort of terrible and frightening things.
And it is.
Okay. What a relief. I've been very conscious with my first two collections, but even with my novel, House of Windows started out originally to be a haunted house novel, and it kind of moved into sort of a combination of haunted house novel and a story of like a curse. As we said, I suppose this brings us back to the beginning of our conversation, that you know, for me, one of the great things about working in a tradition is seeing all these different things lying around. Oh, you've got an exorcism narrative. Oh, you've got a werewolf story, you know, whatever, Frankenstein's monster, you know. What can I do with that? What are the, and for me, I often feel as a writer, it's this tremendous benefit because you have all this pre-existing armature in place, and then you can pick and choose, and maybe you knock the whole thing down and build something else, or maybe you inhabit it fully, or maybe you build something slightly differently around it, or what have you. And so for The Wide Carnivorous Sky, the collection, I was very conscious of having, here's your werewolf, and here's your vampire, and here's your ghoul, and here's some Lovecraft stuff. And I thought, oh, well, an exorcism narrative, that would be a perfect way to end this thing. But it just, it kept growing. it just kept growing until it really was, you know, sort of long novella, short novel length. But Derek Hussey, my publisher, was just quite stoic about the whole thing and just said, yep, okay, great, we'll take it.
Well, it has, and it actually has, and it's embodied in a quote in the story. It has everything it's that you want in this, which is at one point one of the characters thinks that this was everything about religion she couldn't stand: the sin, the superstition, the violence. And I think that sums up the story in a way. But also, I mean, that's a good perspective on religion as well.
Well, I think when you're dealing with the numinous, for me anyway, and I went to Catholic school for 12 years, so I mean, maybe that says all that needs to be said right there.
Says quite a lot.
But for me, it these kinds of things inevitably impinge on horror narratives, on supernatural horror narratives, maybe even on non-supernatural in a more philosophical sense. And I've always been fascinated by, you know, sort of comparative religion and myth studies, you know, Frazier and the Golden Bough, and, T.S. Eliot and Faulkner as well, Yeats. So it was kind of fun, ultimately, unexpected, I have to say, because I didn't really think the story was going to go into that direction. But ultimately, when it did, I did sort of think, oh, well, I guess this makes sense.
Well, it also makes for a great and very intense reading experience.
Yeah, my hope really is that at least there's one or two stories in here that you know, you won't be able to put down, that will reward the attention that you give to them.
I'd say that's true for every story. I've been speaking with John Langan. His new collection of short stories is The Wide Carnivorous Sky and Other Monstrous Geographies. Thank you for joining me, John.
Thank you so much for having me, Rick. I really appreciate the time.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.